The Kalamazoo Cold Case team spent 2 years investigating Jeff Titus before he was finally arrested. And for a time, their investigation almost seems to have stalled out. Aside from the statements from Jeff Titus' old co-workers at the VA, the Cold Case team wasn't able to find much in the way of new evidence. Then, in 2001, Detective Mike Workema decided to get the FBI involved.
We called up the behavioral science people on at Quantico, the FBI behavioral science people. Workema did. And they agreed to look at the case, and we boxed up photos, all the case file, everything, and sent it down to them.
That's Detective Rich Madison. He'd been originally assigned to the Titus case, but was eventually removed after he concluded that Titus was not a viable suspect and that the investigation should go in a different direction. Despite this, Madison had been asked to join the cold case team when, a few months later, the FBI's behavioral science unit let the cold case team know that they'd finished their review of the case.
And they called up and said, okay, come down and bring your prosecutor with you. So Stu Fenton and all of us packed up and drove to Quantico and met with them one afternoon. And it was a room full of PhDs. You know, the guy in charge of polygraph for the FBI and these other PhD behavioral science, psychologists, psychiatrists, whatever.
The goal of the behavioral science unit is to provide support for criminal investigations through behavioral analysis. By classifying crimes based on offender behavior and developing psychological profiles of suspects. It was a member of the behavioral science unit who, back in the 1970s, actually coined the term serial killer. And for the Kalamazoo case, the behavioral science unit had been asked to look at the materials in Jeff Titus that were provided by the cold case team and determine whether he was responsible for the murders at the Fulton Game area. After bringing in the cold case team to talk about their investigation into Titus, the FBI officials at Quantico gave their verdict.
And their, everything was yeah, coming from the FBI. Basically, their message was, yeah, he did it. He fits the profile.
Detective Madison was still not convinced. And before the Quantico trip, there had been other members in the cold case team who had shared his skepticism. But once the FBI's behavioral science unit announced its conclusion that Jeff Titus matched the profile of the killer in the Fulton Game Area case, any remaining doubts among the rest of the cold case team members were soon erased. The behavioral science unit was, after all, the ultimate authority in criminal profiling.
They sent it to Quantico, to the behavioral science team. Now, these guys are the best in the world. In the world!
It was 2 months after that trip to Quantico that the cold case team obtained a search warrant for Titus's property. The affidavit in support of that search warrant declared the following, quote, in June of 2001, the cold case homicide team traveled to Virginia to meet with profilers from the FBI's behavioral science unit. Based on their thorough review of this case, the FBI believes that Titus is the only viable suspect in the killing of Bennett and Nestis. The FBI's behavioral science unit hadn't always felt that way, though. Because just 10 years earlier, the behavioral science unit had actually identified someone else as a viable suspect in the Fulton Game Area murders. The FBI thought it might have been a serial killer.
A madman was hunting humans.
Well, and the man they're calling the hunter-sniper,
an unusual hunter, one who hunted men.
The deadly serial killer who preyed on hunters.
And welcome to Undisclosed. This is episode 12 in our series, The State vs. Jeff Titus. My name is Rabia Chaudhry. I'm an attorney and author of Adnan's Story, and I'm here with my colleagues, Susan Simpson and Colin Miller.
Hi, this is Susan Simpson. I'm an attorney in Washington, D.C., and I blog at The View from LL2.
Hi, this is Colin Miller. I'm an associate dean and professor at the University of South Carolina School of Law, and I blog at Evidence Prof Blog.
March 14th, 1992. I remember getting the call at home from one of the detectives at Coshocton County telling us what we had.
FBI agent Harry Trombitis was with the FBI for 29 years. After details in Omaha and St. Louis and New York City, he transferred to the FBI office in his home city of Columbus, Ohio, which is where he was when that call came in from Coshocton County.
Claude Hawkins was fishing at the Will Creek Dam area. It was a cold, blustery day, and he had his back to the roadway. If you picture a river and, you know, somebody standing on the bank fishing, and behind you would be like a wooded area and then a roadway. Somebody shot him in the back, and he died immediately.
That Saturday morning, Claude Hawkins had gone fishing at the Wills Creek Dam. It's a somewhat desolate area. The dam was located in an abandoned strip mine about 60 miles northeast of Columbus. The dam was owned by the federal government, which meant the FBI shared jurisdiction over crimes that happened there. That's why after Claude Hawkins' body was found, a detective with the Coshocton County Sheriff's Department got in touch with the local FBI office.
The next morning, I ended up going to Coshocton and meeting with investigators and, you know, coming up with a game plan on how we were going to work this case. And, of course, we had no clue who might be responsible. One of the first things you want to try to do is to make sure that you eliminate family, friends, work associates, anybody who might have a reason to kill a victim.
There was no one who had any reason to kill Claude Hawkins. He was 49 years old, married with four children, and worked the midnight shift at a glass plant. He lived a quiet life and had no enemies, no problems with anyone. His main hobby was fishing, which is what he was doing at the Wills Creek Dam that day when he was murdered. And it was clear that this had indeed been a murder.
It would be highly unlikely that anybody would be hunting in that area. And so, and there were no shell casings. We believe the individual was savvy enough to know that you don't want to leave shell casings and that behind. And so took his shell casing and got out of the area as quickly as possible.
The killer left only a single clue behind: the bullet that he had used to kill Claude Hawkins. A single round fired by a high-powered rifle was recovered from his body. Beyond that, though, the investigators had next to nothing to go on. There were no leads, no suspects, no witnesses. But there was something about the case that seemed familiar to one of the investigators working on it.
I remember specifically, and I give a lot of credit to Dane Shryock, who was one of the detectives from Coshocton County, when we were driving out to Mansfield to meet with Claude Hawkins' family. We were just talking about, you know, have you had anything like this? And Dane mentions that he remembers a case in Tuscarora County in 89, a case in Belmont County that were unsolved as far as he knew. And people had written them off sort of as hunting accidents. But now that we had this case, it really looked to Dane like, you know, we ought to take a closer look at this and let's get everybody together. And I was in total agreement. That's about when we formed our task force and got all the investigators together so that we could determine, you know, we would sit down face to face and everybody would talk about their particular case. You know, and we could all see the similarities or the dissimilarities. And it turned out that we were able to link in the Tuscarora County case involving Donald Welling in April 1st, 1989, to the series. Jamie Paxton, that was murdered in Belmont County on November 10th, 1990.
The first victim was 35-year-old Donald Welling, who was killed in Tuscarora County, two counties to the north of where Claude Hawkins had been killed. Donald had been shot once at close range with a 30-caliber rifle while walking along a sparsely populated stretch of county road in Tuscarora County. 1 year later, and two counties to the east in Belmont County, 21-year-old Jamie Paxton was shot and killed while bow hunting in an abandoned strip mine area. According to local news reports, the coroner concluded that Jamie had been shot three times, once in the leg, once in the back, and once in the chest. While two shots had been fired from a distance, the coroner said, the fatal shot to the chest had been a close contact, as shown by powder burns on his jacket. Then, just a few weeks after Jamie Paxton was killed, a third outdoorsman was murdered.
Then we were able to link in tentatively, because it was a little bit different, Kevin Loring, who was from Duxbury, Massachusetts, and was visiting Ohio, some family and friends here, and went hunting. He was shot and killed when he didn't show up to meet his hunting party. At the end of the day, they went looking for him, and that's when they found him. So he was shot and killed. We weren't sure if that particular case was a hunting accident or not, but the other ones we were pretty sure were not hunting accidents.
30-year-old Kevin Loring had been deer hunting with relatives at a reclaimed strip mine in Muskegon County, just 5 miles southwest of where Claude Hawkins was murdered. But at the end of the day, he'd failed to return to the parking area where everyone had planned to meet up again. His body was found by a search party the following morning. He'd been killed by what investigators reported to be a shotgun blast to the face, which had been fired at close range. Initially, they believed his death had been both a hunting accident and self-inflicted. It had appeared to investigators that Loring had stumbled while walking through dense brush and accidentally shot himself in the face with his own shotgun when he'd fallen. It wasn't until that afternoon that the game warden arrived at the scene and realized that Loring's shotgun had been fully loaded when it was found. The fatal shot could not have been fired by his own weapon. Someone else had fired the shot that killed him.
There were some important differences in all four of the cases the task force initially identified. Two of the victims had been shot at a distance, from at least 20 to 30 yards away, while two appeared to have been shot at much closer range. And each of the four had been shot with very different types of weapons.
Well, we looked at, certainly, like I said, the similarities. We also looked at the ballistics information, you know, what kind of a round was used. The first two cases were such that we believe them to be different. The third one, the Loring case, he was shot pretty much in the forehead, and the damage was so severe that we were not able to determine what type of weapon was used with him. And so we weren't sure if it's shotgun or rifle or what exactly was used. With Claude Hawkins, we knew that it was a rifle. We knew it was a Swedish Mauser, and we knew what type and what the ammo would be.
The victims themselves differed in notable ways as well. Each of the four victims had been in a different county when they were killed. Some of the victims had been shot multiple times, and they ranged in age from 21 to 49.
One of the differences in the Claude Hawkins case was he was a black man. Everybody else was white males. So we thought, could this be racially motivated at first?
Yet despite these differences, there also seemed to be a pattern emerging. And the reason the task force had been formed was because Trombitis and the other investigators had come to suspect that these murders were all the work of one man. They thought they might be dealing with a serial killer.
You know, when you look at those cases, they were individuals that were out by themselves, usually engaged in some type of outdoor activity. And then on April 5th, we had another homicide, Gary Bradley, in Caldwell, Ohio, on April 5th. 1992, who was out fishing by himself and was shot in the back and actually shot a couple of times.
Now, noting the existence of a pattern is one thing, but proving that these cases really were connected was another. The only real clues the task force had to go on came from the bullets that had been recovered from the victims, and that hadn't gotten them very far. The first four victims had been killed with different weapons. Then, after submitting the bullets recovered from Bradley, the fifth victim, to the FBI lab, the task force got its first real break in the case.
And with Gary Bradley, it appeared that it was the same weapon that was used to kill Claude Hawkins was also used to kill Gary Bradley. So the ballistic information, even though a couple of the cases were different, they were similar. They were high-powered rifles.
Gary Bradley and Claude Hawkins had both been killed by the same type of weapon, a Swedish Mauser. And according to the forensics lab, most likely the same Swedish Mauser had been used in both crimes. And there was another striking similarity that all five of the murderers seemed to share.
We also looked at the dates that these occurred. Four of the cases occurred on the weekend, and only one of the cases occurred during the week, but it was the day before Thanksgiving. So somebody could have taken off if they were employed. We assumed that they were employed, and that's why the cases were happening on the weekend, because they were busy Monday through Friday.
After reaching the tentative conclusion that one person was responsible for committing several of these murders, if not all of them, the task force turned to the FBI for help.
Back then it was called the Behavioral Science Unit, and so whenever we have a case like this where there's, you know, maybe a serial case or anything like that, something unique about it, we like to involve them because those agents back there work these cases every day. They see hundreds of cases from around the country.
The FBI's Behavioral Science Unit agreed with the task force. They developed a profile of the suspected killer. And what they came up with was pretty much exactly what you've guessed, based on what was known about this case so far. According to the profile, the killer was a white male in his 20s or 30s. He was of above average intelligence and a loner who kept to himself. He was also an experienced outdoorsman who was comfortable in the woods and likely had a job working Monday to Friday. He determined the killing location ahead of time to familiarize himself with the areas and become comfortable there, then waited for a target of opportunity. When he wasn't killing people, the Behavioral Sciences Unit predicted, he filled his time by committing arson and killing animals. As the months went on, the Behavioral Science Unit's profile of the serial killer became more detailed and more personal.
Suspect has the mentality of an arsonist and is basically a coward. The suspect has an inner problem that he deals with by killing, which becomes easier and more exciting for the suspect. The suspect is also most likely spending time back in areas where homicides have occurred at. Also, a little variance in the crimes is not uncommon. As an example, a wallet messed with, or the use of a handgun.
The Behavioral Science Unit also began trying to identify additional cases that might potentially be linked to the five killings in southeastern Ohio that the task force had identified.
That's how we became aware that there was another similar type case to what we were experiencing in the southeastern Ohio, because we had our cases going on and we were looking for other similar cases. Certainly the Kalamazoo case stuck out as a potential. We also had another case in Steuben, Indiana, that we considered a potential. We had several other cases in Ohio back in the 80s that we thought might be potentially linked as well.
The Kalamazoo case was, of course, the murder of Doug Estes and Jim Bennett on Saturday, November 17, 1990. The Indiana case that Trebitus mentioned was the murder of Vernon Eicher, who was killed almost 1 year to the day after the Fulton Game Area murders, on Saturday, November 16th, 1991. All three men had been deer hunting when they were shot and killed, and the FBI thought it was possible that all the cases were linked. That's why the Ohio Task Force was put in touch with Kalamazoo County Detective Bruce Rasima.
We had information that we had there was a serial killer in Ohio, and that kind of fit our criteria for what was going on. Because he was going around to different areas, randomly shooting people. They had a task force down there that worked it up. Myself and another officer, Lieutenant Van Streen, traveled to Ohio.
Once the Kalamazoo County investigators had been alerted to the existence of a possible serial killer who was targeting hunters, they began investigating that angle as well. They developed a few potential suspects of their own, men who could have possibly fit the profile and who were known to hunt and travel through Indiana, Michigan, and Ohio. They passed these leads on to Agent Trombitis, though none of them checked out in the end.
I remember interacting with Kalamazoo, the sheriff's office, and great guys. You know, they obviously were dedicated like we were to trying to get the case resolved and as quickly as possible, because if in fact we had a serial murderer that was not only hitting in Ohio, but hitting up in Michigan and maybe in Indiana, you know, every day was, you know, a potential another day that the person could kill somebody.
There was a lot of pressure, a lot of urgency to get this case solved, but not much evidence to go on. The task force had the ballistics evidence that linked the murders of Hawkins and Bradley, but that was pretty much it. And then someone remembered that the year before, an anonymous letter had been sent in to the Belmont County newspaper.
After Jamie Paxton was killed in Belmont County back in on November 10th of 1990, Mrs. Paxton, Jamie's mother, was notorious for writing letters to the newspaper right after the incident happened and continuing on for months, talking about how, you know, the person that shot my son was a coward. She was just letting out, you know, I think a lot of her hurt and sorrow over what this person did. And she was hoping that somehow they would read that and then maybe perhaps, you know, get a response in that. And sure enough, that's exactly what happened. A year after the anniversary, an anonymous letter was sent to the Times Leader newspaper. That's the Belmont County newspaper.
The letter was signed "The Murder of Jamie Paxton," and it was addressed to both Paxton's family and Belmont County law enforcement. In a portion of the letter directed to Belmont County Sheriff Tom McCourt, the letter says,
"Don't feel bad about not solving this case. You had no clues of any kind to start your investigation. You could interview till doomsday everyone that Jamie Paxton ever met in his life, and you wouldn't have a clue to my identity. The reason? Jamie Paxton was a complete stranger to me. I never saw him before in my life, and he never said a word to me that Saturday. The motive for the murder was this, the murder itself."
The letter had been written on a typewriter. It's in all caps, with various typos superimposed with lines of X's, and with text that meanders unevenly across the page. It has the sort of disjointed format that makes it look pretty much exactly what you'd expect an anonymous letter from a serial killer to look like. And the letter writer makes it clear that is in fact what he is. Technically, he writes, "I meet the definition of a serial killer. Three or more victims with the cooling off period in between. But I'm average looking, family, job, home, just like yourself." The letter writer says that Jamie Paxton had been killed because of, quote, "an irresistible compulsion that he had. I knew when I left my house that day that someone would die by my hand," he wrote. "I just didn't know who or where." The letter writer goes on to describe in detail how he killed Jamie by shooting him three times. And all three shots, he claims, were from a distance. "There were never any shots fired at point-blank range," he wrote, "as I was never closer than 100 feet to Jamie. The coroner was mistaken in his analysis." The letter ends with an admission and a warning.
"Clearly, I committed aggravated murder and would be sentenced to death. I knew the difference between right and wrong at the time and was sane. I've had dozens of opportunities since that November day to kill others in Ohio and other states and chose not to. Let's all hope that this will be the end of the killing, but at this point, I don't know."
Somewhat surprisingly, it was not this letter that first tipped off law enforcement to the possibility of a serial killer targeting hunters in Ohio. The letter had been reported on in the local paper, but it was largely ignored.
The letter to the newspaper was in 1991. But the task force isn't really...
Until Claude Hawkins was shot and killed. Right, right.
So...
Right, the letter came up afterwards. Once we got our task force together, after Claude Hawkins was shot and killed, Sheriff McCord from Belmont County, you know, said, "Hey, don't forget we have this letter that was received." And so we started focusing in on that letter. But until then, we hadn't really linked any of the cases.
From local news reports in Belmont County, it appears that law enforcement didn't actually believe the letter was genuine. The letter writer had given a detailed description of how he'd killed Jamie Paxton, but that description contradicted a number of conclusions the Belmont County Sheriff's Department had reached. Although, Sheriff McCourt conceded, the letter writer had correctly identified the caliber of ammunition used in the killing. Still, the sheriff doubted it was real. After all, Ted Bundy had never written a letter like that. And besides, there was no reason to believe a serial killer was active in the community. According to the Belmont County newspaper, quote, "The sheriff said there were no similar cases reported in Ohio or in surrounding states." That wasn't true, though. There had been, by then, at least 8 other homicides that were roughly similar.
The task force had been formed in April of 1992, and for months the investigators tried to identify who their likely serial killer might be. But after concluding that the same weapon had been used to kill Hawkins and Bradley, there were no further breaks in the case, and every single weekend, the task force feared that the serial killer might strike again. On Saturday, May 9th, 1992, less than a month after Gary Bradley was killed, another hunter was killed, this time in Meigs County, in southern Ohio. 57-year-old Ronald Pohl had gone out turkey hunting with his son that morning, each going their separate way in the woods, with plans to meet up again at noon. But Ron Pohl never returned. That afternoon, a search party found his body in the woods. He had been shot once in the back with a double-aught buckshot. On the morning of July 21, 1992, a Tuesday this time, two hunters in Dillon State Park in Muskegon County reported that a man in a red Toyota pickup had pointed a rifle at them, taking aim at them as if he was about to fire. Before he could, though, the man realized the two hunters had seen him, and he jumped into his truck and left. That same evening, over in Jefferson County, a father and son reported that they'd been fishing in Jefferson County when they too had seen a man with a rifle take aim at them, and he'd fired 3 shots at them. He had missed, though, and the father and son had been able to run for cover and were able to make it to their own truck and drive away uninjured. Finally, in August of 1992, after failing to make any further progress on the case, the task force decided it was time to go public. They notified the media that there were 5 murders that they believed had been committed by the same person. These 5 were the very first 5 cases that the task force had become aware of: Donald Welling, Jamie Paxton, Kevin Loring, Claude Hawkins, and Gary Bradley. All 5 fit the profile of the serial killer that they suspected was targeting Ohio's outdoorsmen.
But when we released those, that was after consultation with our behavioral science unit and all of us getting together and discussing our cases, and we saw enough similarities that we were very confident that they were related.
As expected, this announcement brought a great deal of media attention. National television news programs like Inside Edition reported on the story.
We know of 5 murders in 5 different counties, all in a bordering area over in eastern Ohio.
There are several common links between the murders. Authorities say all of the men killed were either fishing or hunting alone on a weekend and were murdered with a high-powered rifle. Investigators say these apparently random killings may be the work of a serial killer.
This publicity brought the task force new leads on the case. Hundreds of new leads, in fact.
We knew once we did that, we were going to get all kinds of phone calls. And sure enough, we did. There were a lot of, you know, ex-wives calling in, you know, saying, "Hey, my husband's goofy. You know, he hunts in those areas. You know, you might want to take a look at him." You know, just people throwing names and things out. And we were able to eliminate most people very quickly, simply by matching up either work records or, you know, where they lived, you know, that those kinds of things. There were a number of factors that we used.
Then television program A Current Affair ran its own report on the suspected serial killer.
When we brought you the story of a deadly serial killer who preyed on hunters in Ohio, we had no idea we would help lead authorities to an arrest. As Lyndall Marks reports, Richard Fry was watching that story when he realized he knew a man who'd allegedly been killing animals exactly the same way, a man who had been his friend since junior high.
Well, I was watching A Current Affair one evening, and they had a story on there about a serial killer that was involved in a number of slayings in southeastern Ohio. And some of the characteristics of these slayings reminded me of an individual I knew.
After seeing the report on the possible serial killer, Richard Fry had called Detective Walt Wilson at the Tuscarawas County Sheriff's Department with some information he thought the task force should know about.
But we got a call from an individual. He said, you know, I read the profile that was released. I want to talk to you about my friend Tom Dillon.
42-year-old Thomas Lee Dillon lived in Magnolia, Ohio, a suburb of the city of Canton. He was married, had an 11-year-old son, and worked as a draftsman for the city waterworks. He was an avid hunter and was described by those who knew him as a gun nut. He was also a loner, and aside from some co-workers he was friendly with, his only real friend was Richard Fry. And now Richard Fry could not shake the suspicion that his friend Tom was a serial killer. As a kid, Fry told Detective Wilson, Dillon had frequently committed petty crimes, things like stealing leather jackets from department stores and stealing someone's motorbike. But by the mid-1970s, after they graduated from college, Richard Fry began to realize that his friend's misconduct was escalating to more disturbing patterns of behavior.
It started out just shooting dogs at the dump, scroungy, diseased dogs at the dump, and then he became to the point where he wanted to shoot just any dog or cat he came across.
After the dog killing began, Fry began to distance himself from Dillon and did not see him for many years. Then, about a decade later, the two ran into each other at a gun show, and they renewed their friendship. That's when, Richard Fry told the task force, he began to realize that his old friend's behavior had only grown more extreme over the years.
So I started going out with him, and we do a little hunting, and then he started telling me more about his exploits, and some of those exploits I think are rather serious. He's burned down buildings, abandoned buildings according to him. He at one time told me that he saw a truck out in the rural back areas. A truck had car trouble with the hood up. He stopped, put a 30-round clip in an AK-47, and emptied the clip into this truck. His 8- or 9-year-old son was with him at the time, but Tom started driving these rural areas very, very heavy. It's not unusual for Tom to go 50, 75, or 100 miles away in these back roads. He knows these back roads like the back of his hand, and so on weekends, he would travel these roads. Tom mentioned to me, you know, it wouldn't be hard for me to go out, shoot somebody along the road in a rural area, and shoot them and leave them, and they would never catch you because there would be no motive. Well, that's absolutely correct, and apparently he also learned from these books that if you went outside of a county and committed a murder in a different county, of course, there was a jurisdictional problem, and it may take a while for the police agencies to discover that there was a series of crimes that were related to one another.
There were other things about Tom as well that, in hindsight, Richard Fry now found to be rather suspicious. Once, Fry said, he and another friend had been with Tom Dillon when he'd used a handgun to fire a shot at a farmer a few hundred yards away. It was too far of a distance for Dillon to have had any real chance of hitting the farmer, but Fry and the other friend had been upset by it, for obvious reasons. And Dillon had a habit of buying new weapons at gun shows, only to suddenly sell them off just a few months later. But when Richard Fry would tell Dillon that he'd be interested in buying those weapons off of him, Dillon always refused and insisted on selling the weapons to strangers instead. After learning about the serial killings, Richard Fry began to wonder if his friend had a very specific reason for refusing to sell those weapons to someone who knew him. For the most part, Fry didn't know anything that could directly connect Dillon to any of the suspected serial killings. There was one possible exception, though. In 1990, the weekend before Thanksgiving, he and Dillon had gone to Pennsylvania together on a deer hunting trip. They'd returned to Ohio on Tuesday evening, but before they parted, Tom had mentioned his plans to go deer hunting the following day somewhere to the south. On the afternoon of November 28, 1990, the day after Tom and Richard returned from their hunting trip to Pennsylvania, Kevin Loring had been killed while deer hunting in Muskegon County, three counties south of where Dillon lived.
Tom Dillon was just one of hundreds of names that were called into the task force after they went public with their belief that a serial killer was hunting Ohio's outdoorsmen. But all the other leads were going nowhere. Someone would call him with a promising suspect, but after investigation, that suspect would have to be ruled out. For most investigators, the case had become dead end after dead end.
So we'd come back downtrodden and upset that we just didn't, weren't getting anywhere. And then Walt would show up And you go, I can't eliminate my guy. And at first we thought, well, you know, you just haven't done enough things yet, Walt. You'll be able to clear him out. And then we go, you know, everybody would have a new set of packet of leads. And then we'd come back and get back together. And, you know, Walt would come back in. He said, you know, I can't eliminate my guy. And at one point, you know, one of the big things was, you know, these all these homicides occurred on the weekend, with the exception of one. And one of them occurred on Wednesday before Thanksgiving. And Walt was able to go and talk to this supervisor of Dylan at the Canton Water Works, where Dylan worked, checked Dylan's vacation time. And in fact, Dylan took off that Wednesday when the homicide occurred.
Tom Dylan was the first suspect the task force had that they could not rule out. But they had no evidence that could justify an arrest.
When someone brings a name up to us, we just that's not probable cause to go out and arrest that person.
Due to their growing concern that Dylan could be the serial killer they were looking for, the task force decided that on Saturdays and Sundays, a surveillance team would be deployed to track Dylan's movements.
Yeah, surveillance of Dylan was almost next to impossible. Things that you should keep in mind, I think, are number one, how difficult surveillance is in the first place. I did 6 years in New York trying to follow people around. It's just difficult. But you have all that cover in a city. You know, you're just one of a million cars.
Almost every weekend, Thomas Dylan would leave his home using his red Toyota pickup truck and spend hours just driving around. But Dylan wasn't driving through cities. On these weekend trips, he was driving hundreds of miles up and down through backcountry roads.
So picture yourself, your team, trying to follow somebody in a rural area where there's hardly any other cars around, when all that person has to do is look up in their rearview mirror, and if you're not careful, they're going to see 4, 5, 6 cars behind him, you know, because we don't know where he's going. We don't know the areas. We had to stay close enough that we wouldn't lose him because we were always fearful. He may see somebody and just pull off the side of the road and shoot him. And we tried to get the aircraft up as often as we could. If we got the plane up, you know, we could back way off and the plane could call out where he's turning and different things like that.
It wasn't just the possibility of Dylan shooting someone that the surveillance teams were worried about.
Every morning that he would leave his residence, one of the first stops he would make was at the local Dairy Mart, not too far from his house, and he would go in and he would buy beer. And we know that he's drinking and driving. What happens if he goes left of center and he kills a family?
During these weekend drives, Thomas Dylan would start drinking by 8 a.m. and wouldn't stop until he got home for the evening. And on one occasion, Dylan drove his truck into a ditch and had to be pulled out by a neighbor. But usually Trombitis says this was not the case.
You could not tell that he was drinking. He drove straight. He never weaved. He went the speed limit. He just looked like a regular driver.
But Dylan was not just a regular driver, because during these weekend cross-country drives, he made frequent stops in isolated locations.
I described Dylan when we followed him and we saw some of the things he did, a one-man crime wave. This guy, one day we followed him on surveillance and we saw him shoot stop signs, electric meters. Somebody was selling a car. We saw him get out of his car, pick up a rock, and throw the rock through the windshield. Any chance he could, he would shoot an animal.
The surveillance teams had been given strict instructions not to interfere if they saw Dylan shooting cars or signs or cows or committing other acts of vandalism. But if they ever thought that Dylan might harm a person, that's when they were to blow their cover and move in immediately and arrest him.
course, this plan was based on the assumption that if Dylan ever did try to shoot someone, the surveillance teams would be in a position to prevent that from happening.
If you had seen him, like, prepared to take a shot, were you close enough where you could have...
Well, that was the thing. I mean, it was a battle every single day to walk that fine line between being too far away to lose him and that. And we lost him a couple of times.
On the occasions that the FBI lost track of Dylan, he did commit crimes. He killed a number of cows, shot up some water meters. One time they lost him, and then 2 hours later an arson was reported. Someone had burned down a barn about 5 miles from where the surveillance team had last had eyes on Dylan. And then, on one occasion, Dylan came close to committing a much worse crime.
We had the plane up, and the plane says, okay, he's going down. Wait a minute, there's a jogger in the road. Dane was with me. We teamed up that day, and we look at each other, and we're going, holy shit. And we're listening to the plane, and okay, he's coming by, he's slowing down, he's next to the jogger, and the plane says, okay, he's going past slowly, and it turned out to be a female jogger, and okay, he's past the jogger, and he's going down to the next, intersection. Dylan's going to the right, then he squares the block, he's making another right. And so he's basically squaring the block so that we think he wants to go back and get the jogger. And so the jogger by then had made it to the stop sign and had turned left. Dylan doesn't know that. He's circling. He goes back down, and as he's approaching the stop sign, he stops. Fortunately, he turned right. And he went away from the jogger. And, I mean, you talk about pucker factor.
The woman who was jogging down the country road that day hadn't been the only close call either. After Dylan's arrest, a man called into the task force to say that on November 4th, 1992, at about 4 in the afternoon, he'd been fishing at the Wills Creek Dam when he noticed a man watching him from the path. The fisherman packed up and went back to his car, and the man who was watching him had returned to his red Toyota pickup. But after seeing Dylan's picture in the paper after his arrest, the fisherman recognized him. He was sure Dylan had been the one watching him at the dam that day. And the surveillance team's records show it could have been him. On the day the fisherman saw the man watching him at the dam, the task force had ended its surveillance a little after 2 p.m. Most, though not all, of the presumed serial killer's kills had happened before noon. So one day, after Dylan had returned home for lunch, the task force had called up its surveillance for the day, because shooting people after lunch wasn't part of the pattern. Not usually, anyway. But that day, it seems that Dylan broke the pattern. If the fisherman was right about who he saw, Dylan had gone out driving again, and this time, there was no surveillance watching him. If he tried to shoot the fisherman at the dam, there would have been no one there to stop him.
The surveillance wasn't the only investigation into Thomas Dylan that the task force was conducting. At one point, they'd asked Richard Fry to wear a wire and to join Dylan for one of his weekend drives, and Fry had agreed to do so. Although the cassette recording has gone missing, we have a transcript of the meandering conversation between Fry and Dylan. Fry is the one who brings up the topic of the possible serial killer, and Dylan starts talking about it. He mentions having seen the same news segment on A Current Affair that Richard Fry had seen. Although Dylan criticizes how, in the show's reenactments, they had shown the killer wielding an M14, which, as Dylan apparently recognizes, was not the weapon the killer had used. When Fry suggests, apparently in a joking tone of voice, that the killer could be Tom Dylan, Dylan responds, apparently also in a joking tone, "Could be me. Could be you, though. Maybe it's me and it's you. Maybe you've got three and I've got three." Then Dylan adds, "It would be hard to even know where to start if you were trying to investigate these serial killings. It's like how it was with Ted Bundy. It took them 2 years before they even realized the murders were connected." The two friends also talk about the movie The Silence of the Lambs. It had just been released the year before. In the movie, FBI agent Clarice Starling tries to track down a serial killer known as Buffalo Bill, who turns out to have been living in the town of Belvidere, Ohio. a town that's just a couple counties away from where Dillon and Fry were driving around. Isn't it weird, Dillon and Fry remark, that the film was set right here in southeastern Ohio? And then Tom Dillon tells his friend, they should have kept Ted Bundy alive. Bundy could have solved this case for them, just like how they had Hannibal the Cannibal help Agent Starling track down Buffalo Bill.
The task force continued its surveillance on Thomas Lee Dillon throughout October and November of 1992, and although they collected a mass of evidence about Dillon's petty crimes and acts of vandalism, they were still no closer to proving that he had committed any of the murders.
We knew that we were running out of time. Hunting season was right around the corner, and we just couldn't allow him to be out there. And we figured that we got a pretty good handle on the kind of things that he does, but we knew that it was more important to bring things to a head and hopefully go into the second part of the investigation, which was when we would be able to announce to the public that we had a suspect.
Even though the task force was not able to arrest Dillon for any of the murders they suspected he'd committed, they were able to arrest him for something else. In 1991, before anyone suspected there might be a serial killer in southeastern Ohio, Dillon had been caught by a park ranger having a silencer on a weapon, which is a federal offense. He was charged, he pled guilty, and was put on probation.
What had happened during our surveillance was we had followed him up to the Cleveland IX Center, and we actually had someone go in and we saw him purchase a handgun. And that was in direct violation of his probation. And so we knew from that moment on that at any point we could arrest him and, you know, get him off the street.
Thomas Dillon was arrested on federal weapons charges on the morning of November 27, 1992. He pulled into the Dairy Mart to buy his usual morning six-pack when the ATF pulled up behind him and took him into custody. Initially, and much to Agent Trombita's and Detective Wilson's disappointment, Dillon had refused to be interviewed, and he'd been taken away to the jail for booking.
All of a sudden, Walt gets a call on his cell phone, and he answers it. And it was the Stark County Jail. The message was, Dillon wants to talk to you. So Walt says, we'll be right there.
Agent Trombitas had hoped they might get a confession from Dillon. Dillon did not cooperate.
I hear you saying you're not going to admit anything, but I want you to look me in the eye. Look me in the eye and tell me you didn't do
it. I didn't kill anybody.
Okay, you didn't kill anybody.
Didn't kill anybody. I did some pretty fucked up, crazy things, but I didn't kill anybody, did
it? I didn't kill anybody, Dillon told them. I didn't kill anybody. I did some pretty fucked up, crazy things, but I didn't kill anybody, damn it. But even though Tom Dillon denied being the serial killer that the task force was searching for, Dillon's denials were something less than absolute.
Because it'd be unwise at this stage of the game. That's what happened.
I think it would be unwise at this stage of the game to say something, he told Agent Trombitas, leaving open the possibility that at a later stage of the game, it might make sense to finally admit his involvement. But even though Dillon did not confess to the murders, the news coverage that was generated by Dillon's arrest finally gave the task force the big break in the case they'd all been waiting for.
December 4th. We got a call from a gentleman by the name of Al Cope, who recognized his picture and even had the ATF form still where he purchased the Swedish Mauser 6.5x55 rifle from Mr. Dillon. And he still had the gun.
A Swedish Mauser 6.5x55 rifle was the same type of weapon that had been used to kill Claude Hawkins and Gary Bradley. And Mr. Koch told the investigators that he recognized Dylan as the man who sold him the rifle on April 5, 1992, the same day Gary Bradley had been killed. But Gary Bradley had been killed in the morning and Mr. Koch had bought the gun in the afternoon. There would have been just enough time for Dylan to have killed Bradley, then driven to the gun show to sell the rifle to Mr. Koch. The gun was immediately sent to the FBI lab for testing, and a few days later, the forensic analyst called Agent Trombitis up.
Bob started talking his firearms language to me. He's like, you know, the Q1 specimen, you know, is linked to the, you know, the R something. I said, Bob, cut the bullshit. Talk in terms I can understand. What does this mean? He said, you got the right gun, dumbass.
In January of 1993, Thomas Lee Dillon was indicted on two counts of murder, based largely on the strength of the sales record that linked Dillon to the Swedish Mauser and the forensic evidence that linked the Swedish Mauser to the murders of Claude Hawkins and Gary Bradley. At a press conference held to announce the charges, a senior FBI official told reporters that the investigation remained ongoing. There were additional murders that they suspected Dillon might have committed.
I think we have a total of approximately 10 homicides that we are looking at. We have gotten a couple of individual calls from Indiana and Michigan and perhaps Pennsylvania, but I couldn't confirm that.
Two men in Michigan named Bennett and Esther were killed on November 17th of 90. Are these two of the 10 that you count?
Yes, they are.
The FBI had identified the murders of Jim Bennett and Doug Estes as a case that was potentially linked to the serial killings in Ohio. But just 3 weeks after this press conference, it was reported in the press that Dillon had been ruled out in the Kalamazoo case, and he was no longer considered a suspect, because the task force had concluded that the Fulton Game Area murders did not match the profile of their serial killer.
You know, the fact that there are two people together, you know, that is something that Dillon would not have had the chutzpah to try to do two people, okay? He wanted somebody from a distance, if possible, by themselves, middle of nowhere. So for him to go after two people at the same time would be something that, I mean, he said that he would never do, and based on what I know of Dillon, he would never do. Second of all, it sounds like they were shot with shotguns. Dillon, when he killed, he used a rifle.
The murders in Kalamazoo didn't fit the pattern of the first five cases the task force had initially linked to the possible serial killer. In the end, it was those five cases and only those five cases that Dillon pled guilty to. For his crimes, Dillon was sentenced to life in prison, and he died in 2011. Agent Trombitis and the other task force investigators do not believe that he committed any murders beyond the five that he confessed to.
Well, you know, one thing I'll say is we never caught Dillon in a lie. He was always upfront with us. Once we had him, and that he was, we were able to verify the information and that he told us. You know, as I said before, he didn't take responsibility for either the Steuben case or the Kalamazoo cases, and we believe he was being truthful.
Thomas Dillon denied that he had committed the murders in Michigan, or the murder in Indiana, or the one in Pennsylvania, or any of the other Ohio cases beyond the first five the task force had found. And a serial killer would never lie, would he? Next time, on Undisclosed. That's all for episode 12 of Undisclosed, The State vs. Jeff Titus. We're back next Monday with episode 13, and don't forget to send us your questions for this week's addendum episode with the hashtag UDAddendum. Amethal Telhan is our executive producer. Our logo was designed by Baluki, and our theme music is by Ramiro Marquez. Audio production was done by Rebecca Lavoie of Partisan Crime Media and host of the Crime Writers On podcast. And music from this episode is by Blue Dot Sessions. Transcripts for episodes are available on our website at undisclosed-podcast.com. They're brought to you by our amazing transcript team, Dom Logus, Britta Bliss, Skylar Park, and Eric Fladell. And of course, thank you to our sponsors for making it possible for us to come back week after week. You can follow us online and on all social media. Our handle is @UndisclosedPod. We're at Instagram, Facebook, and Twitter. And if any of our listeners out there have information on Jeff Titus' case that they'd like to share, we'd love to hear from you. You can reach us at undisclosedpodcast@gmail.com, or you can call and leave a message at 410-205-5563. That's all for this week, and thanks so much for listening.